Okay, well, it really has been a blessing to be able to be part of this camp and to get to know some of you better and to be able to minister God's word to you. I hope to see you again in the future. And if you ever come down to the Hillcrest Way, please come and visit our church and meet my wife and my kids. I'll have four by then. It's a lot of kids. Well, actually, no, we're just warming up, right? Where's Tim? I mean... Well, just to help us realize the premium that... sorry, did I do something there? That was me. You know, at our church, thanks. When I got to our church, they'd never had any sound issues, any trouble with the sound desk or the volume or anything until I came. And after that, they had to spend literally tens of thousands of rands on a new microphone, a new desk, and new speakers and everything just to get, because my voice is so difficult to hear, apparently. I mean, that's what my kids say too sometimes. We didn't hear you, Daddy, but so wherever I go, there seems to be technical glitches. Sorry about that. To help us understand the premium that Jesus set on relationships and how relationships important they were to him compared to anything else in this world, we're going to look at an interesting little parable today that confused a number of people, but hopefully we can bring some clarity to that in Luke chapter 16. Let me ask you, what do the British pop bands Eco Belly, Suede, and Primal Scream all have in common? Yeah, funny names. There you go. What else do they have in common? Well, they've all made millions from selling their records. They're big in Europe, I guess. They all three bands had band members that had absolutely no knowledge of accounting. They all three got into trouble for not paying their taxes. They were all three surprised by the fact that they got into trouble for not paying their taxes because they thought that they had been paying their taxes very loyally for all those years. And they all three used the same accountant. Accountant Frank Dixon was placed in complete control of the finances of these three different rock bands. And over 8 years, he slowly siphoned off £20 million of their money. And the reason they didn't even realize that he was stealing from them is because he never, very shrewdly, he never took any money from his clients. He never stole any of their profits. All that he did is that on the accounting that said how much tax they needed to pay, and it was the right calculations, so anyone who double-checked that would see that amount, instead of paying that then to the tax man, he just paid that to himself. And nobody was any the wiser, you know. They were still making their profit. They were still becoming rich. They were getting all their money from all their sales, except, of course, for the tax money, which they assumed was going to the tax man for all these years. And so that's how he made his money. But Dixon isn't your average, everyday, greedy swindler. He is a mastermind. You know, most swindlers with that kind of money, they would take that money and they would start spending it on lifestyle things, buy assets, you know, buy a nice car, fancy clothes, go on big vacations, maybe buy a Learjet or something, big mansion. And that could raise suspicion in the mind of your clients. You know, if your accountant is making way more money than you, then maybe there's an issue when you're a multi-zillionaire rock band. But so he didn't do any of that. He just lived a normal lifestyle, didn't spend any of the money. All that he did was he invested that money in business opportunities, little businesses, lots and lots of small business ventures, and he started business partnerships and became a silent partner in various businesses and just funneled all the money into other opportunities and put the money to work for him for these 8 years. Well, eventually, you know, the tax man came knocking on the door, not his door, of course, but the door of the clients. They were the ones that were responsible for not having paid their taxes, but it did catch up to him, and he was expecting that. He had studied the law about these things, and he knew exactly how to argue his case, and since he hadn't bought any major assets, there was nothing for the bank to repossess or take away from him, and he was sentenced to a mere 1 year in a minimum security British prison, and he didn't have to pay any of the money back because, well, he didn't acquire anything with that money. So upon his release, he simply went to all of the people's businesses that he had invested in and started asking for dividends to be paid at that point. And he started, you know, pulling a little salary from each of these businesses. And he retired at age 47, making millions of pounds every year from the businesses that he had put his money into. And all for just 1 year in prison. Now, is what Frank Dixon did despicable? Absolutely. But isn't there just a little part of you that thinks, wow, that was pretty smart? I mean, you shouldn't do that, but if you are going to do it, that's a pretty smart way to do it, you know? Spend 1 year in prison and at age 47 be a millionaire the rest of your life, and, well, the strange thing about this scenario is that Jesus would probably have commended him too. If you don't believe me, turn your Bibles to Luke chapter 16. This is the context is that Jesus told some parables about the coin and the lost coin, the lost sheep, and the lost son, the prodigal son. And his point there is that a person's soul is more important than anything else. You know, the coin and the sheep and the son all represent sinners, lost sinners who then return, who get saved, and there's rejoicing in heaven over them. And just the weight of a soul in eternity outweighs any kind of physical possession at all. And that's the point of those parables. And now the rest of the chapter, chapter 16, is going to deal with money. But this parable is a great transition because it has both themes, the themes of the importance of evangelism and the importance of a human soul, as well as the theme of how we spend our money. And so it's going to be interesting for us to see how Jesus talks about money being used to build relationships, and that relationships are far more important than anything else that you have. And so we'll pick it up here in Luke 16, verse 1. He also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that his man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do? Since my master's taking the management away from me, I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. And the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings.'" Well, that's the parable of the crooked accountant. And a manager, or a steward in this case, is put in charge of this man's estate, is put in charge of his possessions, a businessman, a master. In our day, we would call this your financial manager, or your accountant, or whatever. In the days of Downton Abbey, this would be Mr. Carson, you know, and he's the head butler, the head steward that's over the entire estate. And then there's Lord Grantham would be the master, right? And Lord Grantham doesn't really know what's going on in the house because the steward's taking care of it. We saw this with Joseph too, didn't we? In Genesis 39, Potiphar left all that he had. This is verse 6. Potiphar left all that he had in Joseph's charge. And because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food that he ate. You know, basically, Potiphar, if he sat down and there was a steaming hot meal that he enjoyed, that's all he cared about. He just assumed Joseph was running everything else. And so this is how people used to run their estates in those days. Now, this is the advantage of being uber rich, okay? I mean, if you're that rich that you can afford to employ a manager to run everything for you, then you can focus on really important things like investment strategies or your golf swing or updating Facebook or, you know, whatever you want to when you're that rich. I mean, you know, Lord Grantham just stands there and everyone dresses him, you know, and he doesn't have to do anything. And that's the advantage. The disadvantage is what? Well, the risk that you get a crooked accountant who starts stealing your money and you don't know about it, right? Because you've entrusted everything to him. This is everybody's greatest fear. And what would you do if you even heard rumors about your financial steward siphoning money off for himself? Well, you'd fire him on the spot, and that's what happens here. That's exactly what happens. Verse 2, he called him and said to him, "What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager." This is the equivalent of have your desk cleared out by the end of the day, or what Donald Trump tried to trademark. You're fired. You know, this is him just getting fired on the spot. Just the rumors were enough. Now, the accountant doesn't argue because he knows he is actually a crooked accountant and he's been caught out. He's quite a devious guy. And so he gets fired for wasting money. Do you think he's ever likely to find another job in finance? Accountant gets fired for stealing money from his client. Do you think he's ever going to get another accounting job anywhere? No, he's going to have a vocational shift here. So he kind of looks around and sees what other people are doing, and there's a ditch digger. And he's like, I'm not strong enough to do that. That looks sweaty. That looks like real hard work. I'm used to sitting in my accounting office with my laptop and air conditioning and a secretary. You bring me coffee. I can't do it. And then he looks to the other side, and there's a guy with this cardboard sign, you know, don't feel like working, please give me money, or whatever they write, you know. He's like, well, I've got a bit too much self-respect for that. I'm not going to beg. So, and my degree's in accounting, and that's kind of, that ship has now sailed since I've got this reputation. What am I going to do? And anyone who's ever been fired or retrenched knows what thoughts immediately start popping into your head. You're thinking, what about the house payment? What about the car payment? What about the school fees? What am I going to tell my wife? You know, and you start worrying and you start getting desperate. You start, I've got to come up with some sort of plan. Not ditch digging, not begging, but something in between. So his devious little mind hatches a sinister plot to feather his nest for the rest of his life. In a sense, you could say life gave him lemons. He's going to make a lifetime supply of lemonade. Instead of using his last few hours to clean out his desk, he sets up a series of power lunches with his boss's debtors. And this is brilliant. Look at verse 4. I've decided what to do so that when I'm removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. You see how he's planning his future, other people are going to owe him something. Verse 5, so summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. So that cost about 1,000 denarii, and a denarius was one day's wage of a laborer. So this is, you know, the ditch digger's three-year salary, some sort of investment that the guy took out, futures in oil or whatever, and now he owes this huge amount, this like three-year salary amount to the master. And the accountant says, well, I'm in charge of the finances and I'm helping the master streamline things. And so I tell you what, we're going to streamline this. Is it okay with you if we just forgive half of your debt? yeah, okay. I mean, I love how he says it here too. He says to him, 100 measures of oil, and he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly. I like the word there, quickly. Right, 50, like, come on, let's get this on. You're with the deal? Hurry up. I got lots of these to get through for the rest of the day. You know, I'm on a tight schedule. My desk is supposed to be cleared out by sundown. Quickly just write this down. Yeah, thanks for the hugs and kisses. Go. Okay, next, quickly, send them in. You know, he's like in a hurry here. And the next person comes in, and I still owe 3,000 denarii, you know, 100 measures of wheat. That's 3,000 denarii. I mean, that's just like unpayable debt. And he's like, okay, well, cut that down to 80 and going, oh, thank you, kiss. And so the implication is that he spent the whole day doing this, not just these two, but that all of the debtors, one by one, coming in, sitting in the waiting room there, like, I wonder, is the master going to raise the interest rate? What's the issue? And then everyone comes out smiling, beaming, like, yeah, you know, and goes out, and the person's like, wow, this looks like good news. And they come in, they see the seedy little accountant there, quickly, sit down, how much do you owe? Okay, cut that in half. Is that okay with you? Yes, okay, go. Oh, wow, this is awesome. So, I mean, they just want to hug this guy. They just want to please him somehow. Thank you. I mean, and is he doing something ethical here? No, you know, they don't care. Would you care? You know, if someone from your bank just came and called you and said, you know what we're doing, we're cutting your home loan, your bond, we're just going to cut that in half. Is that okay with you? Who is this? No, I want to speak to your manager, please. I want to speak to somebody firm and in charge who might say no to that. And you're like, yeah, can I get that in writing quickly? You know, I've got the email. You know, yeah, you're thankful to this person for doing that, and that's exactly what's going on here. Now, unfortunately, Christians get quite embarrassed by this parable. Commentators, you know, the PhDs have to write something about this that doesn't sound like Jesus is saying, go and defraud your boss. That's how Christians are. I mean, the master commends him for doing this, right? Jesus says, go and do likewise. I'm like, this is great. So Christians are allowed to steal from their boss, you know, as long as they do it quickly. No, that's not what's going on. So what commentators try to do is they try to say, well, in those days, you know, the law of Moses said that you weren't allowed to exact usury from people. You weren't allowed to take more than was ethical. And in those days, the interest rates were so high and all the shrewd steward, they would call him, is doing is he's helping the poor victims of the bad master to, lower the debt to something that's more reasonable and blah, blah, blah. And so actually they spend a lot of pages in these commentaries trying to make the case that he's a righteous steward. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all. Jesus calls him an unrighteous steward. He calls him, in verse 8, the dishonest manager. And you know, if Jesus is the master here, you don't want him to be the bad guy that the shrewd steward's fixing. And if this, and Jesus calls him a dishonest accountant. So why try to say, no, Jesus is saying this is a good thing? No, it's not. He's bad. So what's going on here? How come the master, in verse 8, commends him? The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. And then Jesus says, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. I wish Christians would be more like the people of this world. You're like, what? No. Is this like an apocrypha that we're reading here? This can't be the Bible. Surely they're the sons of light. But so what's going on here? Well, Jesus is saying that we need to be like this crooked accountant, but in only one specific way. Now, the golden rule when you interpret parables is that unless Jesus gives multiple different interpretations for each little detail, like for the parable of the soils, for example, where the birds represent this and the seed represents that and all this kind of thing, every other parable is just, there's only one main point. If you ever read a parable and you're like, what does this mean? Just remember that for every parable, there's one main point. And that's the point that you need to find. And all the other details in that just help hold up that point. You don't want to build like six different doctrines from every parable. You just look for the main point. And in this one, the main point, Jesus will explain to us in a second. But look at what he's being commended for in verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager, so he is being unethical, for his shrewdness. For being prudent, for being clever, for his craftiness. You know, all of those words kind of sound a little bit dodgy. I mean, you wouldn't want your accountant to have on his business card, you know, or a list of endorsements. I've been called crafty by Business Week. You know, I've been called shrewd by Investment Magazine. I have a reputation of being, you know, no, you don't want that. But there's an aspect in which what he's doing is right. I want you to be like this man in one particular way. The way he handles time and money. That's how Christians need to be. That's what's commendable about him. He realizes, I mean, this guy is an expert in the efficient use of resources. He has two resources, two variables. He has money at his disposal, and he has a short window of opportunity that's busy closing. And what he does in that short period of time with that money that's been entrusted to him is brilliant. It's clever. Now, it's dishonest, but even the master said, yeah, that's better than spending the day cleaning out your desk and going finding a job. Spend the day using the money that's entrusted to you to do something that'll benefit you in the future. Just like Frank Dixon did. He didn't spend the money all those years he was stealing it. He invested it so when he came out of jail, he could sit back and legally live off the proceeds. And that's what's going on here. Commentator Daryl Bach summarizes it well. He says, people in the world give more thought to their physical well-being than the righteous do to their spiritual well-being. You know, unbelievers are smarter than we are, really. Unbelievers, when they're dealing in temporary, financial, worldly investments, they're better than believers, and we're dealing with eternal, spiritual investments. Who should be smarter? Who should put more emphasis on what you're going to do with your resources? The unbeliever is just doing it for money in this life, what Jesus calls unrighteous mammon, the god of wealth? Or should the people be spending the most thought and careful, shrewd investment strategies and tactics and meetings and decisions be the ones who are deciding how to use that to impact eternity? And specifically, we'll see, to build relationships. So Jesus is saying, in a nutshell, use your short life with the closing window of opportunity, you know, we're all dying, on preparing for eternity, not for this short life. People who spend their time investing in this life are missing the point. You should be investing on what's beyond this when the window of opportunity closes. Be like this guy who realizes time is running out, so use your time and your money wisely. That's all Jesus is saying. And he makes it clear in verse 9. He says, I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth. Now, he doesn't mean that you need to go and make, you know, sordid gain. He just means that all money, the word's literally unrighteous mammon, just this worldly, you know, it's when you die and you get to heaven, you don't take any of that with you. You don't have numbers in a bank account. You know, there's no Swiss bank account in heaven. You don't have pockets in your robe for your little wallet with your Visa gold card. Everything's gold in heaven anyway, you know. It's any money you brought would be pretty worthless. It's like there's nothing. You can't take that with you. You can't take any of that stuff with you. It's just unrighteousness. It's just it's the opposite of eternal righteousness. But you can do something with it now that affects eternity. You see, there's only one thing that can transfer from this world into the next world. There's only one thing that is now part of matter, our flesh, our stuff, that separates from the matter and then can transfer into the next world and live forever. And what is that? Your soul. A soul is the only thing that lives for eternity. From the moment a child is conceived, that soul will live eternally somewhere, starting on earth and eventually in heaven or hell, forever and ever and ever. And so what you do with the stuff you're given now, your house, your car, your bank account, your education, whatever resources you have, your skills, all that, whatever you do with it, you build a huge empire now, it's just, that all gets flattened when you die. That just gets left, that's nothing. That'll go to your kids and you think they're going to look after it. You know, no, they're going to, at best, they'll pass it on to their kids, and those kids will become heroin addicts. You know, the richer you are when you die, the more chance you're going to have heroin addicts in your descendants. You're right. It's, people just don't, they don't value that stuff. So why are you spending it so much now in this life when you could be using it in a way to get souls into the kingdom so that when they die, they're waiting for you in heaven? And when you die, you get welcomed in by friends that you've made, eternal friends, relationships that you've forged, relationships that have been created by your worldly, you know, you make a meal now, invite someone over for dinner, an unbeliever, that's real food that you had to go to the shop and buy and use your money that you earned, and you're doing it with physical stuff, and he's eating it, but it's the relationship you're building using that stuff. The guest room that you have, the car that you lend to someone, all these things, how you use these physical things to build relationships. You share the gospel from a point of friendship in that relationship. The person gets saved, and now their soul will one day meet your soul in heaven. It's an amazing thing that we can do. And so the master, verse 8, commends the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation, the stuff of this life, than the sons of light are in dealing with things of eternity. And so Jesus says, make friends for yourselves. Verse 9, I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, I like how he says, not, he doesn't say if it fails, when your wealth fails, they may receive you in eternal dwellings. Your wealth will fail you, because no matter how rich you are, no matter how good you are with whatever God's given you here, you can't use that to make yourself live forever. So at some point, no matter how much medical aid insurance you've got, the doctors are still not going to be able to keep you alive at some point. I mean, they might be able to keep you alive for decades, but one day you're going to be like 112 and getting another heart attack, and the doctors are going to be like, we just don't have anything more to keep this person alive. So maybe it'll take 100 years, maybe it'll take 150 years, but at some point your money is going to stop being able to keep you alive, and it's going to fail you. And you are going to end up in eternity, and then what you did with it, rather than trying to keep yourself alive and well-fed and well-rested and, you know, smooth-skinned and well-dressed and whatever it is, comfortable, rather than spending on that, you've spent it on other stuff that when you show up in heaven, it's waiting there for you, namely relationships, children, your children you've invested into. You know, I feel for my wife sometimes, because she's one of these people, she's really passionate about missions and about kingdom work and the gospel, and that's one of the reasons we clicked, because, you know, I'm South African, and we're going to go somewhere in the world, and I'm going to be a pastor and all this kind of stuff, and we're going to invest in the kingdom. But and she was so involved in ministry, and then she had a kid, and then another one, and another one, and she started focusing more on raising the children and just keeping them, you know, away from each other at lunchtime and cleaning up all the stuff that they do and teaching them manners and about the Bible and just investing in little kids. And sometimes she'll say, oh, I just wish I was useful in the kingdom. And, you know, because she sees me going off and teaching Bible studies and training pastors and going to conferences and stuff and like, wow, like and writing books, like that's helpful in the kingdom, but she's just at home with the kids. And so then I just slap her until I snap out of it. No, you know, then I have to remind her. I have to take her to passages like this and say, no, what's important, we all have our different calling and we all have our different giftedness, but investing in your children, you're at home with your children, what you're doing is exactly what Jesus says is the most important thing a human being can do with his or her time, and that is invest in another human being's soul. And that those children, if my children turn out saved, it'll be because of my wife and God's grace, and just the amount of effort that we've poured into them leads to that. They'll be waiting for us in heaven, probably we'll be waiting for them, but we'll reunite in heaven. And that'll be more valuable than anything else we've ever done. Children, friendships. Maybe you have an unbelieving spouse. Don't get weary of praying for them. People at work. You know, money has an expiry date. They don't print it on there, but it does. Everything's going to burn in the end anyway, and everything's going to happen in a short space of time, and only in this one place, on earth. I once had a vivid reminder of this. I went to France when I was quite young, and I stashed a whole bunch of French francs because they were so much better than the rand. And I was like, this is great, because I was pretty convinced the rand wasn't even going to catch up to the francs. So I had a stash of francs in my safe at home. You know, I was a kid, but I had this. And then I moved. I've always kept it, this little hoard of French notes. And then one day I went back to France, and I got there, and I had my hoard of French notes with me. And they had changed to the euro. And I thought they would still accept the francs, but nobody accepted the francs. I was like, but I got a lot of money here. And they're like, well, yeah, you should have used it when you had it. Now it's too late, you know? So I've still got them if anyone's interested in buying French francs for me for euros. But they'll be valuable one day, maybe. But, you know, all of our currency, everything that we have is like that. It's going to get replaced by the heavenly currency of relationships, and it's all going to be useless. Absolutely useless. You know, in 1323 BC, the Egyptian pharaoh, King Tutankhamun, died, and as per their belief, they thought that you could take stuff with you. And so his pyramid, you know, they piled in all this gold and honey and security guards who died as well while they were in there, and just people, you know, boats and whatever he needed, a whole little lifestyle. And then they discovered the tomb 3,000 years later. And all the stuff was still there. Well, except the stuff that the grave robbers had found first and pulled out, right? But they found all this gold and all this stuff. And you kind of think, what was he thinking? I mean, that's a pretty easy test to see if your religion's true or not. You know, you bury the guy, and a year later, you just go and see. Did he take all his stuff? Was it still there? Oh, it's still there. Oops, maybe we've got the wrong religion. Maybe we should keep this gold out of the tomb instead of burying it for 3,000 years. No, but now think of what the angels think of us. I mean, the angels, they have a very vivid concept of reality, how long eternity is, what's really important, relationships, spiritual kingdom building, and they're conscious. There might be angels in the room with us. We don't even know. They're conscious of what we're doing and what's going on in heaven, and they must be thinking all the time, what a bunch of idiots, you know? Not only is this Egyptian guy burying all this gold with him underground, thinking he's going to take it with him, but look at what the Christians are doing. They're like spending all this money on themselves, just trying to make themselves safer and more comfortable and fatter and whatever, you know, just feeding themselves with Woolies food and and just whatever, you know, instead of being a little bit more frugal and taking some of that money and investing it in missions and in publishing Christian literature and in, you know, building projects. Yeah, you guys are doing a building project. We just finished ours and just finished paying everything off. And it's such a landmark now in the community. People used to drive straight past our church. The guy opposite the road from our church, we lived at the manse. We ordered a washing machine. And he said, where can I deliver it? And we said, oh, to the Baptist church. He didn't know where that was. We gave him the address. He got lost. I said, I got him on the phone eventually. I'm looking at your shop. Just walk to the window. I'll wave to you. That's where we are. I mean, that's how unknown our church was on the main road. Now it's like it's this beacon in the community, and people are like, oh yeah, you're at that new church. I'm like, no, it's been there 50 years, but it looks new. Come on in. And, you know, it's something that's had an impact. There've been so many people that have been drawn just because now, you know, there's a church there, and they start showing up, and every cent that we pledged to that building fund has really now started bearing fruit, and missions. You know, you support a couple that goes, and you're like, okay, send off your check every once in a while to that couple, and then they come back and they do their slideshow presentation, and the people that they're mentioning, those are real people. Those are real souls that didn't have the gospel until this guy went there, and you paid for his ticket. You paid for his food while he was there, and your support of that leads to actual souls. It doesn't matter how many there are, 6, 12, 1,000, doesn't matter. And you're going to get to heaven, and you're going to meet these people, and I'm sure we'll know about that and see how all the connections worked, and you'll be like, wow, I'm so glad I put that amount of money in the plate that day rather than, you know, investing it in my Woolies budget or whatever. And you will, because relationships are that important. I love what the person said when they asked a steward of John D. Rockefeller. When he died, he was the world's first billionaire, America's first billionaire. And when he died, someone said, so how much did he leave? And the guy said, why, sir, he left all of it. Well, yeah, of course. And this was a common teaching of Jesus. He said in Matthew 6:19, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. This is a verse for South Africa, by the way. This is where thieves break in and steal. That's like, they have that on our airports. Matthew 6:19. Welcome to Africa. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. You're saying, well, how can I do that? How can I send my mom's jewels that I inherited to heaven? Well, you can't. But you can turn them into cash and invest that cash in some sort of ministry endeavor that results in souls being saved that go ahead and wait for you in heaven. And that you'll meet there. For where your treasure is, your heart will be also. If your treasure is in heaven, you'll want to invest in heaven. I mean, how many people go, yeah, I've traveled overseas quite a bit, and often there's this like long 6, 8, 10 hour layover in, you know, Dubai or the French airport in Paris, and I don't have a visa, so I can't go in. So I'm just in the airport, you know, for like 8 hours. But imagine I went there and I started, you know, they've got all those cool shops in those airports. And so you go and I say, okay, well, I'm going to buy, why is there no furniture? How come there's no furniture? They've only got clothing shops. Well, why is there no furniture shop in an airport? Because everybody's on their way somewhere else, right? You don't buy furniture in an airport. But imagine I was like, well, I want furniture. I want a bed, and I want a little sink, and I want to build my house here, you know? And I don't care what it costs. Money's no object. I'll spend my life savings for these next 8 hours. What would you think of me? Crazy, right? Just wait. Just chill. In 8 hours, you'll get on a plane, you'll end up where you're going, and then you can spend your money. But that's what we're like. We're in the departure lounge here. We're like, we're on a layover, a little 50, 60, 80, 100-year layover here on Earth. And there's like bagillions of years ahead of us, zillions and zillions and zillions. And we've just this little, and you're like, oh, my house and my bed, waterbed, and I want a nice car to drive around so everyone thinks I'm so great or whatever. And then for billions of years, you're going to be the street sweeper, you know. Because you didn't invest anything in eternity. If you want to know more about that doctrine, there's a little book called The Preacher's Payday that Tim can tell you about, where we go into that and what the rewards are and how you can affect that. But I want to tell you about Hetty Green. Just in closing, the story of Hetty Green to remind you of the importance of relationships and how easy it is to fall into a situation where you're spending your money on the wrong thing. She was born Hetty Robinson, and at the age of 30, she inherited $7.3 million. This was like in the 1930s. She had so much money. In those days, it was a lot of money. She was determined to use the money wisely, and so she became the first woman to really make a significant impact on Wall Street, on the stock exchange. Now, before marrying, she made her fiancé waive all rights to inheriting her money. You know, this is my money. You can marry in, but you don't get any of it. So, and she became Hetty Green at that point. She married Mr. Green. And she was infamous for her frugality. She was a penny pincher. Very, very wealthy lady, and increased that $7.3 million to $200 million on the stock exchange. But she wore only one dress. She only had one dress, a black dress, of course. She was called the Witch of Wall Street. And she had underwear that she changed only after they had been worn out. She didn't wash her hands because she wanted to save money on soap, and she rode in an old carriage. She ate mostly pies that cost 15 cents. And one tale claimed that she spent half a night looking in her carriage for a 2-cent stamp, which she lost. Another asserts that she instructed her laundress to wash only the dirtiest parts of her dress, the hems, to save money on soap. She was known to travel thousands of miles alone in order to collect a debt of just a few hundred dollars. And once her son, Ned, this is where relationships come in, her own son broke his leg, and she was so cheap that she didn't want to take him to a hospital where they would charge him. So she took him to a clinic for poor people where they didn't charge. And when she got there, the people at the clinic recognized her and said, "No, you're a millionaire. This clinic isn't for people like you. Like, we need these resources for people who really need them," and shooed her away. And so instead of going to a hospital and forking out the money, she went home and looked up home remedies to treat the leg. The leg got infected and eventually had to be amputated. Her own boy. Rather than spend the money, she's got millions and millions of dollars, rather than spend a couple of hundred bucks. In fact, in her old age, she suffered from a severe hernia but refused surgery because it cost $150. She died of apoplexy from a heated argument with her maid about the virtues of skimmed milk. I love that. By the time Hetty died, her estate was worth $200 million, though she lived as though she was a pauper. Her son Ned then inherited the fortune. So, guess what Ned does with it? Ned goes to the opposite extreme. He spent so much of the money, he would spend it on wasteful extravagances, including a diamond-encrusted chamber pot, which he used for a toilet. A diamond toilet. Awesome. Got to have one of those. Can't be very comfortable. But anyway, he ended up marrying a prostitute who then also helped him spend his money. But because the money was so, it was just so much wealth, he couldn't spend it. He could never dwindle the capital because the interest was so much from the investments that he eventually died at a young age and left his entire fortune to his sister, Sylvia, who went to the middle. She was, from all accounts, a believer in Christ. She was very generous and very careful with her money. She gave away millions and millions of dollars to worthy causes, and yet was still so frugal that when she died, the full $200 million was still intact, and she left it to 64 different churches, hospitals, and schools. Notice that the hoarder, the spender, and the giver all died with the same net worth. But what about eternity? And friends, we have been given a net worth by God, whatever it is. And how much of your time is spent increasing that net worth or spending it on yourselves and your experiences rather than spending it on relationships that can last forever? I don't just mean spoiling your kids with expensive ice cream. I mean building relationships through gospel endeavor, ministry work. The work that the church does, the local church does in your community, and the work that your missionaries do in the world is the most important enterprise in the universe. And God funds it through one means, the church. The money doesn't come from anywhere else. You guys don't have organizations marketing, raising money for you. It comes from your pockets. It's the only place. That's how God lubricates the machine that reaches the world. And so that is the responsibility we have. I just pray that we would all place a premium on relationships the same way Jesus did and live for eternity. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the examples that you've given us in your word, the clear instruction. I pray, Lord, that you would help us to spend our time and our money wisely, like the shrewd accountant did, the shrewd steward who knew that his time was running out and his resources were going to be snatched from him. Lord, in the same way, our time is running out, and yet there are souls that need to be saved, and we get to be part of that. What a privilege. Lord, I thank you for your son that you sent to die for us on the cross, that he could save us from our sin and from Satan's temptations and from ourselves, Lord, and that you could give us an inheritance beyond anything we can ever imagine. And that you could put us to work in your kingdom right now to add to that inheritance and to bring others along with us. I pray that we would not take that lightly. In Jesus' name, amen.